Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues. I just want to know, normally, through your chair, Cindy, we have, what did we resolve? Did we not resolve that all these matters that we discussed will go back? Just point me to where that is, because you've got discussion up to 20 was requested. So is that what we actually, or normally I know you do it a bit differently, that's fine. Yeah.
All right. Page 7. We put the entire set to you. Any movers for adoption of the minutes? Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Thanks, Madam Kivazana. Duly adopted. Honourable members, in terms of today's business, you'd recall that for the past two meetings or longer, we've been engaging with the AG in terms of reviewing the Public Audit Act of 2004. We've had numerous engagements, and at the last engagement, we went through the presentation by the AG and his team, asked them to look at one or two matters which they've done, and we have got the amended documentation from the AG, which we will probably go through, and we've also asked the legal team to give us their views on the Act, also on what it is that we need to do in terms of the process. So we're hoping that they will do that for us, and the content advisor, if they want to comment, and then for us to decide how we take the process forward. So we have given you about 20 minutes, ma'am. It is 10 past 9, round about 9:30, we'll start looking at you. But if you need more time, we will afford you, but if you can do it in that time, we'll be grateful. Let's then hand over to the legal team. Thanks, ma'am.
Good morning, honourable members, colleagues, and our guests from the AG's office. My name is Fatima Ibrahim. I'm one of the parliamentary legal advisors, and I'm standing in for Advocate Jenkins this morning, who is on leave at the moment. My presentation has two parts to it. The first is just briefly a process for the introduction of an amendment bill to just take you through the procedural steps that we would need to follow. And then secondly, I've just got some preliminary comments on the draft amendment bill. Okay. In terms of Section 73 of the Constitution, I'm sure you're aware that it provides for three types of bills that can be introduced in the Assembly. Those are executive bills, private members, and committee bills. The proposal by the AG would fall into the category of a committee bill because the committee would need to adopt this bill and make it its own. The first thing that the committee would need to do is to request permission from the National Assembly to introduce the draft bill. And the manner in which this is done is in terms of Rule 268, which provides that the committee must table in the Assembly a memorandum which sets out various aspects. This includes the particulars of the proposed legislation, the objects of the proposed legislation, and whether it will have financial implications for the state. In terms of the background documents that I received, I see that the AG did indeed prepare one document relating to the financial implications for further investigations and referrals, but I still have one or two concerns that there may be other financial implications in terms of the issue of surcharges, which I will raise later on. This memorandum is prepared for the committee by the committee secretary. The Assembly has an election to either give permission that we proceed with the proposed legislation. It may refer it back to the committee for reconsideration or otherwise refuse permission. Assuming that permission is indeed granted, the NA may, if it so wishes, express itself on the desirability of the proposed legislation or subject its permission to conditions. The committee itself does not need to pronounce on desirability. The committee thereafter drafts prepares a draft bill. This has already been done for us courtesy of the AG's office. However, there is a section contained within the Parliamentary Legal Services that's tasked and that would be assigned to assist with this process and any further drafting that may need to happen. The next stage is consultation with a joint tagging mechanism for advice on whether it's a Section 75 or a Section 76 bill. Depending on the tagging, the procedure may change. Thereafter, notice of intention to introduce must be given in the Government Gazette together with a copy of the bill or an explanatory summary. In our case, since we have the bill already, we'll provide a copy of the bill. And thereafter, invite interested parties and institutions to submit written representations. The time period here is at a minimum 3 weeks for people to make comments, and we would also need to invite relevant departments and organs of state. So, for example, we can once again invite the AG. We may want to invite National Treasury as it has financial implications and so on. At the same time, the committee will also then report to the House that it's indeed published the draft bill. The written comments that are received will need to be considered, and we would need to deliberate on all of those, because in terms of the Constitution, I'm sure you're well aware that there must be meaningful opportunity for public participation in the lawmaking process. The committee thereafter, after deliberating on the comments received, may decide to make further amendments, whereafter it would be necessary, if there are further amendments, to once again consult the JTM in case it may impact on the classification of the bill. So that may or may not change. Thereafter, the bill then gets certified by the Chief Parliamentary Legal Advisor, one of the other legal advisors designated, for three things. Firstly, that the bill is indeed consistent with the Constitution, that's consistent with existing legislation, and that it's properly drafted in terms of format and style and legislative drafting prescripts. The committee then finally formally introduces the bill by submitting a copy thereof and a supporting memorandum to the Speaker. The JTM tagging is tabled together with the bill when it's introduced. A committee bill is unique insofar as a first reading isn't necessary because it's emanating from the committee itself. The first reading is not necessary. We proceed straight to a second reading where we debate then on the substance of the bill. Thereafter, it gets transmitted to the second house. As I said, depending on the classification, the procedure might be slightly different as to whether you would need the approval of the NCOP or whether you would just allow them an opportunity to make comments. So in short, that is the process that will be followed. I've then also done some very preliminary comments on the proposed amendments. I was not privy to the previous discussions that took place within the committee, so forgive me if some of these things have already been tabled and discussed. It's by no means meant to be a clause-by-clause deliberation, but rather a broad overview of my view on the proposed amendments. Firstly, Clause 1 in the bill, the definition of the word disallowance, the term disallowance. In my view, the definition is extremely broad. It does tie into a substantive provision in 5.1d, but even that definition doesn't actually define what a disallowance is. It refers to expenditure that is contrary to law. It seems to me that the intention here is to refer to expenditure that's either irregular, unauthorized, and fruitless and wasteful. Those are terms that are commonly understood. So my question there is, should we not then beef up that definition to refer to those specific terms, since there is a good understanding of what those terms mean? They can't be disputed. This contrary to law could mean many, many things. Then, there's a new definition inserted of a nominated account. Again, this definition is extremely broad. The nominated account now refers to a case where somebody needs to make a payment and the AG then appears to have a discretion as to which account that money is going to go into. Section 13 of the PFMA does indeed provide that funds that are received by the AG don't have to be deposited into the National Revenue Fund. But I would think that you would need some indication as to how the AG is going to exercise the discretion as to which fund it will decide to put monies recouped into. On what basis will that money not go to the institution from where the loss was actually suffered? Why would it be put in the National Treasury Fund, in the National Revenue Fund, instead of within the department where the loss occurred, et cetera, et cetera? So if they could just please give us some explanation of that. And also whether rights are not affected there, since the debt is a debt that accrued to a particular institution, or to a particular department at least. Then there is a definition of the term surcharge. Now, this is it's a commonly understood term, meaning a fee or additional charge in relation to goods or services. So, for example, you purchase petrol and there's a surcharge when purchasing petrol, or otherwise in the context of a tax regime. I understand that the term is used in other jurisdictions in the same form as what the AG is proposing. However, my difficulty is that Section 77 of the Constitution, which deals with money bills, specifically refers to a surcharge. And, of course, as you know, that money bills falls within the exclusive domain of the Minister of Finance. I don't think this is a money bill. I don't think the intention is for this to be a money bill, but I'm worried that by using terminology that's associated with a money bill, it's going to be a little bit problematic. My understanding of the concept of the surcharge is that it's recovery of loss due to non-compliance with procurement or financial prescripts, rather than an added sort of tax or penalty, as it were. Then, Section 5, this is now the substantive issues. In both 1A and 1B, there's reference to regulations being made. This is a very simple drafting comment that it be linked to Section 52(1) of the Principal Act, which is where the power for making regulations resides. Also, I see the word may is used there, may make regulations now on these issues relating to investigations. And my question there is, should that not be a must? Because your power to make regulations is already in the Act. The fact that you now find it necessary to be specific as to what sort of regulations you require makes me think that that should be a must there. Otherwise, maybe strictly speaking, it wouldn't even be necessary to have those new sections in. Then my main issue is Section 5, and the one that relates to surcharges, and this is where I think I have the most concerns, and I'm going to just speak to the issue as a matter of principle, this introduction of a surcharge. Whilst I'm in full agreement that monies must be recouped where losses are suffered, my confusion comes in as to how this is going to link to the PFMA requirements. Section 38 of the PFMA provides that the accounting officer must take effective and appropriate steps to prevent irregular expenditure, firstly. Then, thereafter, must also take effective and appropriate steps to collect all money due to the institution. Now, it seems to me that there's a role issue here, because if this is the duty of the accounting officer in terms of the PFMA to recoup these losses, and the AG is now purporting to amend the Act to say that they also have the power to recoup losses. Practically, whose responsibility is it for the recovery of those losses? Because I would be wary of a situation where the accounting officer then sits back and says, well, the reason we haven't acted is because we're waiting for the AG to act. So where does it start? Where does it end? Is it perhaps a diluting of the accounting officer's powers and responsibilities? And then also, the PFMA specifically deals with the fact that these are disciplinary offences. They are even criminal offences. And the accounting officer must therefore act in terms of those issues. Are you not going to have a duplication of processes? Because very closely tied into the disciplinary is this decision as to whether the loss was in fact caused by a staff member and whether that loss constitutes a criminal offence in terms of the PFMA. So will there not be then a duplication? Also, the AG is talking later on in the amendments about making referrals to possibly lay charges against people. Again, it appears to me that that it's a duplication. So I would like more information on how they see this panning out. Also, any action like the type proposed would clearly constitute administrative action, and it would therefore be subject to the provisions of PAJA. To me, it appears that there is a disconnect in terms of the procedural steps and the time frames. So by way of example, there is reference to a person making an appeal against a negative finding within 60 days. PAJA, on the contrary, provides a 180-day period for judicial review proceeding. So there appears to me to be quite a disconnect there. I don't think that we can, if I can borrow a phrase, contract out of the PAJA requirements. We may increase the PAJA requirements because that would give somebody more rights, but I would be wary of challenges if you attempt to decrease. Then I also just have practical concerns if this were to be implemented. Things that are not dealt with is issues, for example, of apportionment of blame. Those of you that sit on SCOPA are well aware that you will have several officials that will be implicated in a loss, especially when you're dealing with your very big contracts. So this determination of who is ultimately responsible and where does the loss lie is one that we need to consider. The PFMA suggests that it is the accounting officer that takes final responsibility. So how are we going to deal with those issues? Then also capacity constraints and the issue of cost wasn't dealt with in the memorandum that I had access to. I would think that if you were going to levy this type of surcharge, that it would require that you have some investigative capacity, some expertise. You must remember you're dealing with multiple departments across the board, multiple constitutional institutions. It would mean people physically going to those institutions to interview people, to hear their side of the story, so on and so forth. So I would think that the administrative cost involved in this would be significantly higher than if a department were to try and recoup monies themselves. Then there was an indication that persons who have been found to have caused a loss would be given a time period of 60 days in order to repay those monies. What isn't, certainly I'm of the view that could possibly be unreasonable or impossible. It would depend entirely on the circumstances. Sometimes we have losses that run into the millions, whereas people are earning nothing close to that. If it's a small loss relating to something like petty cash or a three-quote system, yes, it may be possible that an official can pay it back within that period. But it didn't seem to make provision for an extension of the period. I do see that later on there is a reference to payment arrangements and agreements, but that section then doesn't link to the 60-day period. It doesn't say in that section that by agreement the parties may extend the 60 days. So if that is in fact the intention, then it needs to be clear there. Also, the issue of interest isn't dealt with. Does interest accrue on these amounts? What about other costs that are involved? I see that there was a reference to recouping the cost of an investigation. So all of those, I think, need to be thought through a little bit more carefully. Then there was a new section that was added in the latest amendment, which basically mirrors the section about recouping money from officials and now deals specifically with the AO, being the accounting officer. Now, what I'm missing over there is why would it be necessary to be specific now to have provisions dealing with the AO, because in any case, the accounting officer is an official. And if the accounting officer was responsible, then the provisions that you had initially proposed would have been sufficient to cover the accounting officer. The fact that this is now inserted may be interpreted as there being an election as to who to pursue. Do you pursue the accounting officer because it's the accounting officer that takes ultimate responsibility in terms of the PFMA? Or do you decide to go against the official, or do you decide to go against both? That, for me, appears to be unclear as to what the intention was of the separate provision. In short, those are my very broad concerns. My main issue is with the surcharge. The rest of the issues are secondary to that. Once we can decide on the legality and constitutionality of the surcharge, I think everything else will fall into place. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I deliberately allow you to go through all of them because I think many of them we've touched, not necessarily in depth as you've gone through them. Maybe it'll assist us if you went through them one by one so that we can delete them and or agree on them. I see the AG's office is here also, so it'll be an open discussion. So if you went through your comments, just identify the first one. We'll tell you what our thinking was. AG will tell you what their thinking was. And if we need to strengthen, amend, delete, we'll do that. So if you could just point us to all of them as you went through them. The first,
okay.
What was the first one?
So the first, I'm on the wrong page. The first issue is the definition of the disallowance, which I felt was too broad.
Okay. There's a definition of allowance. I think, let me speak for myself. I think what you're saying is exactly what we're saying. We were talking about irregular, unauthorized, and fruitless expenditure. Now, if you feel that it will strengthen it by specifying those, we can specify them. Because I don't think there is any other disallow that the Auditor General can bring other than those ones. I'm looking at members. So if we want to say unauthorized, fruitless, wasteful, then we can do that. AG, do you have a problem with that?
Good morning, Chair and members. No, I don't think the AG will have a problem with specifically referring to those definitions. It links very nicely with concepts that we have already in the PFMI, MFMI, as well as the Public Audit Act. So that should not be a problem.
Members, are we comfortable with this? All right. I'm not sure who is. Are you going to?
Thank you very much. I will do that. Just maybe for the parliamentary people, I'm Marissa Besidenhout, from the Auditor General's Office, responsible for legal services.
All right. So happiness on the first one. Second one, you want to say something on the first one, sir? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Chairperson, if this allowance is going to be a collective, according to my understanding, if this allowance is going to be a collective of irregular, unauthorized, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure, I'm beginning to think of the recovery. Is the recovery of all these items going to be the same? It's expected that the accounting officers should account on each and every one of them. Now, if this definition is a collective of all this, in terms of the recovery, is it going to be the same? I don't know whether I am putting it correctly, but...
No, I think what we're saying is what you're saying. We're not going to make it a collective. We're going to specify that. It's no more going to be disallowed as it's standing there. We're going to say unauthorized, fruitless, wasteful, and all those. So then when we get to the recovery, we'll be able to say we're recovering fruitless or we're recovering whatever. Yeah. That's the suggestion that is being made. Honourable Singh?
Yeah, Chair, thank you very much and thank you for the presentation. What I'd like to know is this word disallowance, from the knowledge of the AG and through you, Chair, and the legal advisor, is this word used in any other legislation, Treasury, et cetera, and is there a definition to disallowance? Because I think we have to be consistent with when we say disallowance, here we're further defining it, but how is it recognized in other jurisdictions within IFSOT?
Honourable Singh, before you come in, I thought we were deciding that we're scratching disallowance and we're putting in the specific. So wherever there's reference to disallowance, that's going to disappear and we will put the specifics into that so that it ties up to the PFMA. That's the suggestion and that's the agreement. I'm looking at the AG's office. That's what we're agreeing on. Does that answer your question?
And I'm comfortable as long as we cover every other, every aspect that actually means disallowance.
All right. The next one, ma'am.
The next one refers to the nominated account, and perhaps we can deal with both the definition and the substantive issue here. My legal question here is, on what basis does the AG have the power to decide where this money will be deposited to? It seems to me that you are, in a sense, expropriating debt. Money that's owed to a department you are now taking control of and deciding that you have the election to put it elsewhere. You can correct me if I'm misunderstanding. So for me, the definition doesn't take the matter any further because neither the definition nor the substantive provision provide any guidance.
All right. Honourable members, any comments? Yes. Yes, ma'am.
No, thank you, Chair. I'm sure if you remember, even the committee had a bit and comfort with this. We even said maybe it would be better if the Auditor General is firstly give us the definition of that National Revenue Fund. Whether is it going to go to the National Revenue Fund or is it going to go to the Provincial Revenue Fund? So maybe you need to give us what was your understanding or your proposal on this end, because we, as a committee, we had that too.
Thank you, Chair. It was my understanding that the Auditor General would specify where the money should go back to, being the amount or the account out of which it was lost or wasted or whatever in the first place. So that it's compensating the department that lost the money and getting the money back to that department, apart from the costs which would then come back to the Auditor General. Because if he would incur the costs of the investigation, he would have to recover the costs himself to compensate him for that. That was my understanding.
What was your understanding?
Jay, when we deliberated on the drafting of this particular definition, we interacted a lot with our accounting and auditing experts. And at the very basis of this one was a concern about the impact of this definition on the accounting practices. Would a disallowed surcharge, when it is recovered, would that be qualified as revenue? And how does the department suffering that loss account for it? And that was why there was a compromise to say all other nominated or an account nominated by the Auditor General was brought in. Should it have an impact on the accounting standards, or should the accounting standards compromise this particular transaction? So ultimately then the decision was to propose to the committee, let's take it back to the source of where this money comes from. So if it's a national department, the source would be the National Revenue Fund. If it is a provincial department, etc., it will be a provincial revenue fund. So that was the thinking behind it. I don't know if my colleagues agree. Yeah, that's the AG.
Honourable Singh?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, that explanation makes sense to me because, any loss to the state should go back to the revenue fund. And if it's appropriated further back to it, see, it could be millions, hundreds of millions. And if it's reappropriated to the department that suffered that loss, then that's another matter. But I think it should go back to the National Revenue Fund.
Okay, let me give you my take, ma'am, and you can decide. I mean, the intention of this bill is for consequence management. Now, if Department A misappropriates funds in whatever manner, the AG picks it up 18 months down the line, gives it back to Department A, my sense is that there is no consequences. Because if you misappropriated funds that were meant for housing and you put it into somebody's personal bank account, then the Minister of Housing, the DG of Housing, everybody must be able to understand the consequences of that mismanagement. But if you just pick it up and put it back, it seems to me that the AG will then be playing a role of, I don't know, not even gatekeeper, but a role of fixer-up. Somebody makes a mess, Auditor General fix it up, it goes back to the person that made the mess in terms of department, and there's no consequence. So I agree with what members are saying. Nominated for me can only mean if it's a provincial misdemeanor, it must go to the Provincial Revenue Fund. If it's a national misdemeanor, it must go to the National Revenue Fund. How that department accounts to the South Africans as to why it
misappropriated. That's the minister and the department's problem. It certainly can't be the AG's problem, SCOPUS problem, or Parliament's problem. I think that was the understanding. And if you think that we are wrong, then we are wrong, but I think that was the understanding. There must be consequences.
No, Chair, I'm in full agreement. I think that we then just need to amend the definition to say exactly what you've said. If it relates to funds that were appropriated from a national revenue fund, that's where it must go back. If from a provincial, that's where it must go back. And then we take out an account owned by an auditee. Because what they've done in the definition is that they've listed the national revenue fund, the provincial revenue fund, and an account owned by an auditee, but they said it includes those, so it's not limited. So my worry there was, if you're saying it includes those, it may then by implication include any others, and you then giving yourself the discretion as to where it must go, notwithstanding that it's in fact state money that was appropriated in a certain way. So if we change the definition just to provide for the provincial and national, then I'm satisfied.
That was mine. Let's look at members. Welcome, Honourable Gordy. That was my one. I mean, my sense is that from the national we appropriated to Department A. Department A messed up. It must come back to the revenue fund. Are we comfortable with that approach?
Yes.
You will record it accordingly.
We can do that. Thank you, Chair. And it does make a lot of sense, and it takes care of our worry about the accounting impact as well. Thank you.
All right. We will do it that way. We will relook at it, give it back to you, and see if it makes sense at some point. The next point, ma'am.
The next one was on the definition of surcharge. As I explained, it's one of those terms that in law is a commonly understood term, and it doesn't seem to me that the intention here is a surcharge. I'm particularly worried about Section 77 of the Constitution because it then seems to take us into the realm of a money bill, which is dealt with completely separately and wouldn't be within our powers. So I think that the term needs to be changed.
Look this side first, look that side secondly, I'll comment lastly, and then we'll round it up. Surcharge, is it an appropriate word? Do we want to strengthen it, weaken it? Honourable McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, my understanding is pretty much what Advocate Prime says, and I think it's the wrong word to describe what we're actually doing. Because it's not a surcharge. A surcharge is like something that you add on top of an amount that's already owed. This isn't an amount that's already owed. This is an amount that's been misappropriated and it needs to be refunded. So I'd have the same difficulty if we call it a levy, because it's not really a levy. We're wanting the money back again. I'm not sure what a good word is, but I would agree that surcharge is not the correct word.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, Chairperson, I've been going through Section 77. And because if you're saying surcharge, it's where it has got a meaning, and I'm not getting the meaning on Section 77, which is the money bills. Because if we're doing this, I remember it very well, that we said we need to make sure that we don't touch on any matters that will need a constitutional changes. So then the word surcharge, you are saying it is associated with the money bill. Can you just explain it more?
Okay. You'll have a chance to explain later on. Let's take all the members' interest, so you'll explain that one. Honourable Singh?
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I'm at the back. Back now. Is recovery and not a word that one can consider? It's actually a recovery of misappropriated funds. It's not a surcharge. I agree with the honourable members. It's not a surcharge. Surcharge is something you charge over and above, you know, what you've charged. So it's a recovery of misappropriated funds.
All right. I associate myself with that if surcharge is going to venture into money bills and so on, then that's not the intention. But it's certainly the... What we understood was that it was recovery of funds as we described in front, unauthorized, wasteful, and fruitless. It's recovery of those funds. So it's really a loss recovery, as opposed to surcharges, loss recovery. That was the intention. Now, if the word
ventures into grey area, I would rather we be very specific. Let's look at you, and then we'll come back to you to give us your response, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. And it's quite interesting because initially when I researched the term of surcharge, I also found this particular definition that Advocate Ibrahim is raising here. But then I went to the foreign jurisdictions, and maybe they apply the concept wrong in foreign jurisdictions because they, for example, in Ghana, definitely use the term surcharge in this context. But if this is going to lead to a situation where we put this squarely into a money box, we need to avoid it. So if we can perhaps think a little bit longer, it can be a recovery, it can perhaps be raising a debt on behalf of the state, or a different kind of concept that we can agree on with the legal advisors. We can also take it back to the state law advisors who assisted us with this one. But I think we need to think a little bit longer about the term and call something that's going to be quite clear.
Ma'am Ibrahim, your thoughts?
On the definition itself, the constitution or legislation itself doesn't define a surcharge. It's one of those terms that is just commonly understood as meaning something in additional to. What the constitution does do, though, in section 77, when it deals with money bills, it gives examples of what sort of taxes and so on would constitute a money bill. And in there, surcharge is listed. Now, if we use the same term, to an ordinary person, it would then appear that you are then going into the realm of Section 77 when that's clearly not the intention. The PFMA simply refers to these things as losses. That's the accepted audit term. I don't know if we want to stick with that or if we can consider something else, but that then brings me to my substantive comments later on as to whether we are not blurring the lines between the PFMA and us, but we can think about it.
So that we don't debate forever. The proposal, well, let me tell you what it is not. It's certainly not an additional tax. It's certainly not a levy. It's none of those things. Our understanding was that Mr. A costs the state money by doing the wrong thing. We want that money back from Mr. A. So it's not any additional charge, it's not any additional revenue, it's about recovery. That's what we intended. You are the experts, the legal, both in the AG and in Parliament. You would need to frame it so that there is no grey area. You understand what we mean. We're saying that it's recovery of loss, and loss that was not unforeseen and all those things. It was deliberate loss, fraud, corruption, that type of thing. That's the intention. So we don't have to debate the English here. We give them the intention. They go and change it into the English and into the accounting jargon or legalese. Anybody else wants to comment on this one? Or are we comfortable on that one? We are. Thanks. Next point, ma'am.
The next issue is the substantive issue where I just need to... this is dealing with Clause 3 in the bill and the amendment of Section 5, so the insertion of the new Clause 1, capital C. So basically the idea of a surcharge. Whilst I'm in agreement that in fact there is a duty to recoup and recover losses, my difficulty here is where the duty lies and if it's going to lie, straddle the lines between an accounting officer and the AG, where does the one start and the other one end? For me, that's not coming across clearly. Is this meant to be a case where the accounting officer has indeed taken steps but has been unsuccessful? And if the question then is, if the accounting officer was unsuccessful, what would be different in this process that would make the AG successful? Or are we trying to take that power away from the accounting officer? My difficulty is how we would read the PFMA provisions together with the proposed amendments.
All right, honourable members, duplication, not duplication, I'm looking at SCOPA because I know when I put my SCOPA hat on, we're very clear what we mean here. Let me tell you, so whilst people are thinking about it, and yes, it'll get back to, maybe we should deal with this whole thing and other people can deal with it. I agree with you, and I was going to raise it, that it seems to appear in this bill that you're not clear, do you want to deal with the the bus driver of JRA or you've got to deal with the MD of JRA, the first point. And why must the AG take it and not the MD of JRA, who's the accounting officer? I'm using it that way. My view, and I agree with you, it can't be an official. The buck stops with the accounting officer. Why they said official and accounting officer, I'm not sure they were going to explain it. So for me, it's very clear. The PFMA, which is the supreme law in terms of financial management in the department, says the accounting officer and or the board. I mean, the DG and the accounting officer being the DG or the board. So that's the person that must feel the pain, where I'm coming from. It's the DG and the board. The second point that I'm raising is, 23 years down the line, practice has shown us that the DG and the board, nobody has been punished. Nobody has been punished. It's there in the Act. Nobody has been punished. It's been very unclear what's the role of Parliament up to now. So what we're saying here is the AG as an independent body must be able to pronounce and say DGA is guilty of X, Y, and Z after investigation, and me as the AG should have the power to refer DGA to the NPA, refer DGA to the public protector, refer DGA somewhere else. Now, there could be an argument, honourable members, that we should be doing that as Parliament at some point, but we failed. We failed to do that because there's always been fudging. Do we do it? Must it be done by the minister? The intention is for us to say that it can't just be that after 23 years, nobody has been held liable. And the AG would pronounce on serious lapses by DG McLaughlin. And everybody else says, so what? He's pronounced on it, there's nothing that he's going to do, there's nothing that anybody else is going to do. That was our frustration, that there must be a way of holding people accountable. So that was the spirit in which we were doing. My take, honorable members, is that anything that refers to officials should be removed. It should be the accounting officer. That's the first thing. The second part, ma'am, that we might have to think about is that we were also saying, and maybe that's not the AG's role, it must be a criminal, but we're also saying that there's a corruptee and a corrupter. So the DG was corrupted inside, but Mr. Gordy, who owns Gordy Hardware, is the one that corrupted him. Surely Mr. Gordy must also feel the pain. So I think that's what we're trying to say, that the AG must be able to say, go after DG McLaughlin, but also go after Plumber Gordy, because they were both involved in it. I think that was the spirit that we intended. So it's two people, inside and outside, but I don't think that it should be officials. It should be the accounting authority, whoever that is. That's mine, but I said that to give you time to think about it. You'll give your comments, you'll tell us what your thinking was, and then we'll agree, all of us, as to how we take it forward, because this is really a brainstorming. Members from the side that want to have a take on it. Everything around surcharge, who should be accountable, why, and how. Let's take Mr. Singh and Ma'am Kunal, and we will then see if you guys agree with us and you can craft it for us. Mr. Singh.
Thank you, Chet. I agree with what you've said, but I just want to throw a few curveballs. Now, I believe the accounting officer should be ultimately responsible for collection, but what if that very accounting officer is the culprit? Because the transgression for misappropriation of the fund resides directly with that accounting officer and not any other junior in that department. What are the mechanisms that we've got to use there? Secondly, there are instances, and it's allowed for in the PFMA, where an executive authority can direct an accounting officer to enter into any transaction. Provided it's, and even if the AO is unhappy about it, he's obliged to act. It must be in writing. He puts it in his file that the executive authority so-and-so asked me to do 1, 2, 3. And if it is found by the office of the AG that transaction was fraudulent or it led to loss of state money, what do we do to the executing authority, the minister. Just those through. And then, last one, Chair. When you ask, how do we go about this? Should it not be all these transgressions and recoveries be a resolution of the House? I'm just asking. Like, you know, when we say we authorize unauthorized expenditure, it takes us years to do so because the process is so slow. You know how it happens. After years, you come along, you bring it to the House, so-and-so department did 1, 2, 3, 4 millions of rand, and then we authorize that unauthorized expenditure, etc. Right? Now, should this not have some what's the legal mechanism to give it teeth so that, you know, it should be a resolution of the House listing all of these transgressions and who we want to recover from? How does the competition commission work? Thank you.
Honorable Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson. I agree with what you have said and what you have said as well. It has always been the accounting officer who takes charge of the appropriation of what is it, the finances within the department. But what I agree with Honorable Simon is, what if he's also part of the transgressions of PFMA? But, you know, the frustration is that they know that, I mean, PFMA is one of the good legislations that we've had, you know. I mean, it's been there since 1999. But the problem of implementing that, they know that there's a problem. It has always been my concern that how do we then pinch and make sure that the account, not only accounting officer, the executive authority, and the junior officials, you know, they take charge of what they've done or how they transgress the law. And, you know, earlier this week, we had a meeting with SIU, and I had a problem when they were investigating what the Auditor General has already investigated. To me, it was like it's double duty. They're doing exactly what the Auditor General has already done. So, I'm not coming to a solution because it's also frustrating me to say who's supposed to be doing what, at what stage. But the main thing is that there are no consequences, and we have to find a way of making sure that there are consequences. Whoever has transgressed, in terms of the surcharge that you have talked about, and then we said it shouldn't be surcharged, but it should be, recovery of losses. So I'm just saying that whoever, it should be clear that whether it's an executive authority, the accounting officer, or any junior official that that transgressed should be punished. Because I think at some stage, those accounting officers just sign off things that they don't even read. So it comes at a price, and they should also, because they are the ones who signs according to PFMA Section 38, they are the ones who have to sign out and say yes to ABCD, so they have to pay. But also what the chairperson has said, it's not only the accounting officer, but whoever made that mistake from the beginning, whether it's a service provider or any junior official, should be punished. But we should find a way of putting it together and make sure that it has teeth, because at the moment it doesn't have teeth at all. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
McLaughlin, followed by Comrade Gordy, and then Suzanne.
Chair, if I remember rightly, the reason why we extended it initially was for the very reason that it's not always so cut and dry that you could just find the accounting officer the guilty party, for want of a better expression. I mean, the accounting officer can put in every possible measure he can think of to prevent some action, and you get a very clever person under him who manages to subvert this and funnel out monies. The accounting officer has ticked every box he possibly could, but there's somebody else who's actually liable, who's actually a criminal party in this, and now you're going to go and nail the accounting officer because he allowed it to happen under his watch kind of thing, which I think would be grossly unfair. It wouldn't really fit in with our legislation in general, and I think that's why we included it here. It should be, I believe, we should say, and whichever other person the Auditor General can identify as being the person who actually did it, or benefited or whatever the case may be. I also think we're going to have a problem trying to, if you speak about the corruptor and the corruptee, the Auditor General has no authority, no jurisdiction over parties outside of government. So that's going to have to be referred to the Attorney General, and his office will have to then take up that section of the NPA. So it becomes quite a complex sort of situation, because even the recovery of the money is, you don't want to turn the Auditor General's office into a collection agency. They would have to issue a certificate and saying this is our finding. It gets passed over to the Attorney General, and he can then do whatever action it is. So also for that reason, that last time I said we need to have a look at whether it's not going to require changes to the Magistrates Court Act or things like that, because there might be some procedure they need, a sort of quick fix procedure, that where there's a certificate from the Auditor General comes to them, they can immediately issue summons and a warrant of execution or something like that, so that this process can just happen without having a long court case first. Thank you.
Honourable Gordy, but before you speak, Honourable, I'm not sure if you've got the act before you, Honourable Gordy. If you don't, we can make it available to you. If you do, the document we're talking to. You're not. You might not have a hard copy. You have a hard copy on you? Yes.
It's not the act, but the
bill. Yes, that's the one we're talking to. So before you go there, Honourable Gordy, I just want to refer you to the bottom of page 6 up to the top of page 7. So that when, because somewhere as we speak, we must respond to each other's concerns. It's not them against us. So I just wanted to show you that. Maybe that deals with McLaughlin's, but you can speak to it, Honourable Gordy, and then Susanna.
Maybe if you could give Suzanne whilst I go through, because after seeing input, I thought I followed the trend, but after the two speakers' input, I thought I'm almost drowning. I'm not sure where the actual focus of the argument is. But maybe let's say, but I think I will be able to make some input after she's spoken.
Suzanne?
No, okay. Thank you, Chair. I hear what you are saying, but I'm on the same page with Honourable McLaughlin's side. That we must remember that our financial regulations in the Treasury, they give powers to different kind of categories, where they'll say a tender that worth so much, 500,000, has to be signed by so and so. And the accounting officer that I did has got no picture of what is happening. And there are other tenders that are, let's say, bring three quotations and then somebody signs. And if you think about those, they could be little, but if they pile up, they become millions. So based on that, I then think that the Auditor General in clause 1C, when they say, if it appears to the Auditor General that any person who is or was in the employment of an accounting entity contemplated that did that wrong, for me it covers everybody, because I think any person, should I as an Auditor General discover that in that time you were in the employment and this is what you have done, there were some irregularities, there was some wasteful expenditure, there was this and this and that, and I am saying to you, we have failed to collect the money, where you behave improper, you know, all those things. For me, that one thing is actually covered. I think the AG covers everybody there, everybody. Because you can't say the Auditor General, well, when the system is the tender by gives powers, you go to the municipality, to the people that give the tenders off about what? 300,000 to sign.
Well, Comrade Chair, I must say in the first instance apologize. I think there was an administrative bungle from our side, because I'm sure you realized that in your previous meeting we were not here. And even now I come without, you know, having had time to go through the documentation, which makes it a bit difficult and challenging. I've read the sections you referred to, but you know, without a proper context and background, it becomes becomes a bit of a challenge to make an intelligence argument. And yet, I think it is probably that one section that is of greatest interest to me, as it talks directly to, after the findings of the Auditor General, then what? You know, so, I'm not sure. I think I'm still trying to tie these things around around my... Because I listened to the argument by Honorable Singh, and I'm reading what is on page 6 to 7. My take is that whatever amendments we're making here will not necessarily in any way amount to the amendment of the PFMA. And the spirit of the PFMA fundamentally is that managers are allowed to manage and to be then held accountable for the decisions that they have taken. And that accountability is either through our parliamentary processes or through the audits of the Auditor General. So I'm moving from that point. I'm trying to link with the current argument where it fits in. So maybe give me some time. I'm sure I'll be able to catch up.
All right. We'll come back to you soon. Let me also give my part and come back to you. I'm 100% convinced that we can't dilute the PFMA. It has to be our starting point. The PFMA is very clear who carries responsibility. It's the accounting authority. Now, I hear what my colleagues are saying here, but it's the accounting authority who must put into place supply chain management department. So whether the bus driver or the lady that makes tea has done the problem, it's the accounting officer, the internal audit, those are the people that must carry the can. And until we do that to the accounting officer, we're going to have a problem. That's my view. We're going to have a problem. We must do it. Let him go to court and say it was Cindy. Because the court will be saying, where were you when Cindy did it? You are the accounting officer. So my starting point, honorable members, the intention is the Auditor General goes and does an independent audit. He finds gross negligence or corruption. He finds it. And by finding it, he would have identified where did it emanate from. He then issues a certificate that says, in my findings, I've picked up this gross misappropriation coming from the supply chain management because they overcharged on the bottle of water. And therefore, I think that money must be recouped. And it comes to Gordy, and Gordy goes and he makes, when I say Gordy, I'm saying Scopus, they make a recommendation. That recommendation goes to the House. Next year, that matter still arises. And the following year, it still arises. And the reason why it arises is because the AG has no power to enforce. Our intention was to say, after the AG, that certificate must be prima facie evidence to the public protector, to the courts of law, that I have picked up something X, Y, and Z, Mr. NPA, charge DGA. That was the intention of it. So there's no duplication of roles. There is no, because the Auditor General comes in after the fact. By the time the Auditor General picked it up, it means the accounting officer didn't do what he or she should have done. They should have done it in the first instance. They have failed to do it. 18 months down the line, the AG picks it up, and he says, I have picked up that you, DG, didn't do it. So he's not duplicating the DG's role. He's coming in when the DG has failed. And therefore the DG must pay the price for having failed or explain why he has failed. So I'm trying to clarify this way. You say, where does one start and where does... By the time the AG's come, the DG's role has stopped. 18 months before it has stopped. Because he does an audit, he sends management letters, the DG and the account and the minister signs it off. Then the AG comes and he picks up this misdemeanor. Your role is finished as DG, he's picked it up. Parliament is saying, now that he's picked it up, make these people recover the money. That's how I understand it. If you guys have put it in any other fashion, then you need to change it if my view is the majority view. But if members have a different view, that's what they must say. But that's how I did it. And I just want to get to the things, to Honorable Singh's one, because I agree that the DG is forced to sign a contract because the minister said X, Y, and Z. My view is the DG must still go and account for it. Let him go to court and say, I did it on the basis of Minister X. Let him go and say that. Because in his defense at court, his defense lawyer is going to be saying, don't hold me accountable, my hands are tied, I did it to Minister X. But I don't think we should dilute that responsibility. I don't think so. I think that let us make, and Gordy, you're right, let those that manage, and if they fail to manage, let them pay the price. That's my idiot's view on how this whole thing should pan out. But let's allow members to exhale, and then the two of you, if you think that you can craft it in that fashion for us, you will craft it in that fashion. But we'll go all the way down here. It's really, honorable members, it's what do we do when the AG picks up fruitless and wasteful expenditure? Let's leave unauthorized for this point on. But fruitless and wasteful, there's no debate about it. What happens when he picks up fruitless and wasteful expenditure? And we had billions of rands of those things in the last time. We'll start by Gordy and go around. What is our thinking? You guys can capture it and try and put it in the legislation for us. All members can comment if you wish to.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Comrade Chair. I do think that as the PFMA stands, it is the accounting officer who is given all the power and the rights to manage. That is why the PFMA say one of the duties of the accounting officer, they must prevent irregular, fruitless and wasteful as well as unauthorized expenditure, meaning when those occur, the first line of responsibility is the accounting officer, because you are duty bound in law to prevent those things from happening. But you see, there are two levels. One, it might be so that I'm the accounting officer, but a junior officer in the supply chain management actually did the actual trick, the actual giving of a contract unlawfully to a friend. So my accountability as, say, maybe there was bribery or money laundering or whatever, if you now take it criminally, I suppose the person who actually received the money or the person who actually did the trick, that is the person who committed a criminal act. But the accounting officer is guilty in the first instance of failing to prevent that, right? So, but when you go to court and say who should go to prison and be sentenced, I would imagine that it will be the junior official who actually did the actual act. But the accounting officer is guilty of failing to prevent it. Now, if you have 3, 4, 5, 10 such cases, will that amount to a criminal offense on the part of the accounting officer, that is criminal negligence? Or will that be part of what comes out in the performance assessment of the accounting officer by the accounting authority or by the minister? So I'm looking at it at two levels, in terms of the person who actually presses the button, signs the check, who is under the accounting officer. But the accounting officer is supposed to put in systems that prevent those kind of things from happening. So for me, at our level, the responsibility remains with the accounting officer. And it's for the accounting officer to, just in the case where the accounting officer was forced by the minister to sign a particular tender, it is for the accounting officer to say, this is what actually happened under my watch. And these are the officials that I found have actually committed this particular crime. And if it's criminal, that is why it must go to the police. If it requires disciplinary action, it is the accounting officer who disciplines them. But he or she is guilty as well for failing to put in systems that are robust enough to prevent these things from, you know, from happening. So I think for me that is how we need to look at it. But in terms of the law, if the Auditor General picks up irregularities, it is the accounting officer who must answer to those things. The Auditor General cannot go and ask a chief director why APCD happened. The point of contact between the department and the Auditor General is the accounting officer. So our wording must be the accounting officer is held responsible. And it's the accounting officer must then explain that he either did it or it was some junior official in APCD. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I cannot put it more eloquently than you did, Chairperson, and it's exactly what it is. Where does the buck stop? The buck stops at the table of the accounting officer. That's very clear. But my problem lies with a situation where the AG has to go beyond his mandate, where the corruptor is brought into the whole circle. That's where my problem lies. Because that immediately implicates very huge litigations against the government. So I think that one needs to be looked at in depth, because it has very serious implications. But as for the overlap doesn't exist, or the duplication doesn't exist, because the AG comes in at a particular time after the accounting officer has submitted a certain document. So there's no overlap there. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Ntombela, just on this point, and I'm seeing you come through. I hear what you're saying when you say your difficulty comes in when it's external to the department. But I'm saying that page 7 says the AG is not going to pursue them. The AG will refer it to the NPA. They will do the pursuing or refer it to the public protector, because they're going to do it. AG will just say, I have picked up, this is the DG, deal with it in one way. This is the external person, Mr. NPA, deal with it. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but when we come back, you can respond to that one. I'm trying to respond to your concern that we'll be giving the AG, or we're making his task impossible. I don't think so personally, but you'll have the last bite. Honorable Singh?
I'm exhaling first, Chair. Chairperson, yeah. No, I agree with what Honorable Gaudier said, and you've said in terms of who is ultimately accountable is the accounting officer. But I hope we also remember that we're looking at SOEs as well. So we must cover that aspect, because we do a lot of audit of SOEs, right? Which is done by the Office of the Auditor General. And we'll have to look at whether they're called accounting officers, whether they're called CEOs, or whether whatever they are called, but we've got to include them in. Because then my earlier point about executive authority and accounting officer, yeah, it'll be the CFO or CEO and the board. Because certainly we found that certain board members of state-owned companies have acted extremely irresponsibly in terms of financial management, in terms of micromanaging what happens in SOEs. So just for them to remember that aspect when they come back with the retro. Thank you.
I think it's all been said, sir. I've got nothing constructive to add. Thank you.
Honorable Kuno, anything?
Chairperson, I agree with what the colleague said first, but I want to pose a question to you with your comment about supply chain, that this bottle of water is over time. And I was trying to make it practical, you know, in a department that, you know, there are allegations that the junior officials, actually, the ones especially in the supply chain, are the ones who most of them are corrupt, and they're the ones who are actually in charge. Not what we think, that the people that we think are not in charge, that those are the people who are in charge. So this DG has to sign off a lot of contracts per day or a month or whatever. I don't know how it happens, but maybe the auditor general will know better because they go there and audit them. How is this accounting officer going to find out that this bottle of water, instead of it being charged 20 rand, it's charged 50 rand? How is he going to know that it's overpriced? You know, last week we had it was this month when we had the water affairs where they were telling us about a borehole that is 340 million. When you know that a borehole is 20,000, so you ask yourself, how does it, from 20,000 to 300, what is special about this particular borehole for it to be that much? So I'm just saying, you know, thinking about it practically, how then do you, I agree with you, PFM is clear, the accounting officer, the back of or her, but the problem is that how then are we going to help them to make sure that whatever the price that they get at final and say, you know, this was wrong after they get correction from the auditor general, how then do we help them in that process? And maybe to auditor general, you know, is it Honorable Singh or Michael Fenn earlier on said that you find that executive authority is the one who's actually wrong. But I'm not sure if they give you letters or something, but how then do you help the accounting officer not to be charged with the wrong thing? I know, I'm hoping that I'm not confusing you further, but my question is that you'll find that even though they're signed and they don't even go through what they're signing off, but practically, how are they going to be able to know that this is overcharged?
Or their support has misappropriated, unless if their support is absent.
No, thank you, Chair.
I have been answered, but I just want to be very specific on page 7. Clause 1 says, the chairperson, where it's on page 7, clause 1C. After that, where it says, if it appears to the auditor general that, then instead of putting any person, then we put accounting officer. Then in brackets, we say in terms of section, then we refer to the PFMA. What do we mean by that? I don't know what advocate Fatima will say, but that's what I'll put.
Well, Ndombela, and then Godi, and then we'll allow you guys to try and make sense of what we're saying. Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm so sorry, Siswam. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair. No, I fully agree with honourable members that the bus stops with the accounting officer, but I'm worried about the what is happening in the municipalities where the manager is the accounting officer. Is also included in the act, or are we going to take this issue to the mayor or who else from there?
Chairperson, thank you very much.
there's a portion of the bill that says,
give page number back.
So what page two back? Of the bill, yes. That's to empower the Auditor General to make regulations to guide the Auditor General in deciding on investigations. My worry came because of that, Chairperson, that if the Auditor General were to go beyond his jurisdiction, then we might end up with very serious problems. How far should the powers of investigations go? If we were to approve this, I foresee problems. But of course, there is this argument that it could be referred to the Attorney General. Maybe that is a check and balance to the problem that I'm having. But I also think we should not end up with a situation where we might end up with a who's who between the AG and the PP, the public protector. But these are a chapter 9 that we are creating. Aren't we going to end up with conflicting situations that would be counter to the intentions that we have had at the beginning? Thank you, Chair.
Where is the last slide?
Yeah, sure, Comrade Chair. Like I said, I'm really staggering through the field because it is indeed an area of greatest interest to where I'm standing. I just want to, because my understanding is this, Comrade. In terms of treasury regulation, it is expected that accounting officers, on discovery of an irregular expenditure, must within 30 days determine whether this is indeed an irregular expenditure or not. And if it is, it must be investigated and responsibility be apportioned to any official. The reason we're sitting here is because the accounting officers don't do that. If they were investigating these irregular expenditures within the 30 days that National Treasury required them to do, we will not be sitting here. But we're here because they don't do it. A year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years pass, there is a regular expenditure that has not been investigated, and we don't know who then is responsible. So my understanding is that, and I don't know, maybe that will be covered in the regulation, when the Auditor General audits and find that in COCTA, for example, there are 117 instances of irregular expenditure. And when you look at these 117, you find that 78 of them relate to amounts that are above 50 million. And then there are three that relates to 5,000, 20,000. Depending on how the regulations will be, it might as well be so that the Auditor General might say, if I find that there is a regular expenditure, this has not been investigated, no one has been held accountable, for such regular expenditures from, say, 50 million or 20 million, I want this investigated. So the investigation will be on the basis of what is already in the findings, which will already be in the annual report, but which is not being investigated, about which nothing is being done. So it assists us to say, how do we enforce? Now, whether you say the public protector must investigate, or the Hawks, or you are saying the accounting officer must investigate within 6 months and give a report beyond which ABC steps will be taken, that becomes a matter of application. But the principle is, the law or the regulations require that
The law says there should be no irregular expenditure. But if it happens, the regulations say investigate it within 30 days. And the problem we're having in the country is that that is not happening. And that is where the Auditor General is being roped in. So from where I'm standing, I don't think Comrade Topela, there will be any challenge, because the Auditor General will be picking up from the work that he has done to say, I think this needs further investigation. Whether by the Hawks, the Public Protector, or the accounting officer themselves, I think that will become a matter of practical application.
Let me just answer Kno, and then we'll go to you. Honorable Kno, I think you mustn't forget that we're dealing with the Auditor General's findings. It's after the fact. You asked the question, how will the accounting officer know if this is duplicated? By the time it gets to the Auditor General, he has had an interaction with the department. So the DG is not finding it when it comes to SCOPA. The Auditor General, he picks it up, he goes to the department and he says, my people have found that this bottle of water has been overpriced. So already he's assisted the DG. What we would expect is for the DG then to take steps to rectify it. So even if we take the DG to court, he has no hindrance to say that when I picked it up, these are the steps that I've taken. So I don't think, first of all, he should have had internal controls, which failed. He should have supply chain management, which failed. It can't come to Parliament and then we must say, but look, feel sorry for the DG. I just don't think we should be doing that. He's had internal controls, he's had his department, he's had management letters from the AG. So when Gordy and his people ask that question, he really doesn't have an excuse to say, good evening, yeah, Ivona, this thing for the first time. He really doesn't have it. So I thought, let me respond to that one, but you can respond, then I'll give to these people.
Listen, I agree with you fully. I'm part of SCOPA. I agree with you fully. And they should be more held accountable. But my only question was that, what if it's actually getting over? Did you see this thing? The treasury regulations that Conrad Gordy is talking about, they are very clear. But the Auditor General does not come, he comes after 30 days. That thing, that whatever that has been done already, the wrong thing has already been done. But for him to pick it up immediately, that's the problem, because they never pick up until the Auditor General comes. So that was my main concern. I'm not saying you should shield them. I mean, you can find something that you are not sure of. If you are finding it it's wrong, you have to be punished for that, because it happened under your watch. I don't want to be, misinterpreted. The accounting officers, they have to take the blame. But we have to make sure that as well, that whoever gives them instruction, if it's about them, they should also be held accountable, which is what Suzanne was talking about. That everybody who has been found to have done wrong, they should all be part of the punishment at the end.
Thank you, Chair. I think there are two issues that I quickly want to touch on. The first one is the easiest one. Honourable Thembela raised the issue about the regulations on investigations. I just want to clarify that amendment about regulations for investigations, they don't talk to the referred investigations to be conducted by other parties, for example, the Public Protector. These regulations will talk about a standalone investigation carried out by the Auditor General in terms of Section 5. So the idea behind that was to have regulations not to extend the powers or to broaden it, but to actually more refine or to limit it. The situation that we deal with is the Auditor General receives, in terms of the Public Audit Act, requests for investigations from everywhere. Literally, the man on the street has the authority in terms of this act to come to the Auditor General and say, this is what I'm aggrieved about. And we feel that maybe that would be better dealt with by an institution like the Public Protector. So the regulations we are referring to here, Chair, would be regulations to say the AG does have the mandate to perform standalone investigations on matters received, for example, from Parliament or a committee of Parliament or a legislature or from accounting officers, executive authorities, etc. And then he retains the power to conduct his own investigation. So the intention of these regulations is not to broaden the scope, but to actually to define the sources from where these investigations, requests for investigations come from. So that was just to clarify that point. On the issue about the possibility of duplicating powers that already sit in the PFMA, I have a colleague with me, Mr. Jan van Skalkwijk, who is the corporate executive in Mr. Marquette's office here. He was the author of the process flow. So from the point that the audit starts and when matters are picked up, there is a process that will be followed. And you allow me, Chair, I'm going to hand over to Mr. van Skalkwijk just to give some context about this issue as well.
Thanks, Marissa. Thanks, Honourable Chair. Good morning to all members. I think I'm probably going to end up repeating what the Chair and Honourable Gordy has already very eloquently said, but perhaps it just confirms from our side that our understanding is exactly that. There is nowhere in this draft legislation that we're putting on the table any intention to try and take over the role of anybody else, least of those the accounting officer. This thing is about accountability, and if accountability worked perfectly, there would be no need for us to debate this issue. So, by all means, the accounting officer has got the first stab at it, accounting officer, accounting authority, as appropriate, but where there's then the failure to take this further, this is where this process would kick in. As Honourable Chair has justly said, therefore the whole idea of then intervening and taking things further. So no intention to overstep on that initial role. I think it's important to just remind ourselves again that this thing goes audit findings, potential to refer, and the whole idea of a surcharge is last resort. So if we find ourselves in a situation where there's something picked up that belongs with the public protector, belongs with the SIU, we're not going to overstep on that role, we're going to pass it on. So there's never that intention. So the referral process should ideally take care of that part. The mandate should never be a question. That's not why we're trying to do it. We're not trying to do other people's work for them. I think there's another point that perhaps is just very important to reiterate, and that's the point that was made around the accounting officer. I so fully agree that we start with the accounting officer. Yes, by all means, there may be other people implicated, but that will come out in the court proceeding. By all means, whether it's executive authority or whether it's to the junior side. I think the quotation around accounting officer that's being overruled by the executive authority was well described. It needs to be documented. The moment the accounting officer is held accountable, there's a referral to what's on file, and the process will play out in that direction. Honourable Gordy was spot on perfect, but over time, though, as these things tend to happen under the watch of the accounting officer, there needs to be questions about the accounting officer as well. There is this very definite responsibility for the accounting officer to put in place internal control. And if internal control is proper and strong enough, all the arguments that we're talking about now should not happen. But let's say these fail, either picked up by internal audit or external audit, there should be quick reaction by the accounting officer. Again, if that failed, it's only then that the AG's findings would kick in. And Chair, you've justly pointed out that even there in the engagement process, there's a chance for the accounting officer to react. Really, referral and surcharges happen way down the line. And so if I can describe this whole thing, I would imagine it's absolute respect for the accounting officer, absolute respect for accountability, but if accountability gets stuck, this bill aims to allow the AG to just intervene and make sure that process kick over again.
Thank you so much. You have the last word, Ma'am Ibrahim, in terms of your initial concerns.
Chair, I'm far more comfortable now. It appears to me that the issue is that the draft doesn't speak to the intention. Because if the intention is to deal with the accounting officer, after the accounting officer has failed to act against officials, then I'm in full agreement. But it's going to require some
some drafting amendments to properly reflect that, and also to reflect the procedure that must be followed. Because ultimately, what you want to try and do is to say to an accounting officer, whether or not you are honest and not corrupt yourself, if you fail to act against those that are dishonest or that have failed to act properly in terms of the PFMA, then we will have no choice but to act against you because of that failure. And that is what's now not coming across. In terms of the concerns that the accounting officer may not always be in a position to prevent things or even to try to reclaim some of these funds, there is an Audi process built into what the AG is proposing, and it would be during that process that an accounting officer then would be able to say, but I was on the instructions of the minister, this is why I acted in this way. Then in that case, and I think the AG would agree, we wouldn't even go to court because we wouldn't issue that surcharge, because that Audi test then shows that the person in fact is absolved, as it were, from the claim. So I think it does require some significant redrafting just to show in terms of timeline and also that the action here is against the accounting officer.
Next point, ma'am.
Chair, before I go to the next one, I just wanted to, there was another definition or a term used that I queried, but for some reason I see it's not on my slide. And that was the use of the term oversight mechanism, where this is where a third party now requests the AG to conduct an investigation, an audit on their behalf, and they've now, for the reasons that they've explained, put in certain checks and balances to ensure that they're not willy-nilly doing this for everyone on the street, and they say that the prior approval of the oversight mechanism must be obtained. It's not clear who the oversight mechanism being referred to here. Is it the committee? Because in terms of our financial legislation, the oversight mechanism, strictly speaking, were the POs who are now using the committee. I think that term needs to be defined. So if you could please just note that you need to add a definition there.
Oversight mechanism, I'm assuming, is this body. This is the oversight mechanism.
That is correct, and that is also the terminology that we got from the Constitution, and that is currently in the Public Audit Act.
I'm saying if it's going to make it easier for Joe Soap in the street, you can say the Standing Committee on the Auditor General.
Absolutely, we can do that.
You can put it then I think it will satisfy your concern.
It's just an issue of clarity.
Yeah. Sure. Right.
The issue of the 60-day period for payment over there, I think this is just a drafting issue because, as I said later on in the draft, we do talk about payment arrangements or agreements. It's envisaged that there may be a payment arrangement, in which case, of course, if there's a payment arrangement, one can assume that arrangement would exceed the 60 days, otherwise it would defeat the purpose of having an arrangement. So I just think that we just need some clarity there with the drafting so that it better ties in. And then this issue of whether interest is going to be charged, if you can just consider that.
I think the payment arrangements is the admin stuff. You can deal with it. I agree with you. If it's cash, 60 days, but if it's installments, it's obviously more than 60 days. I'm looking at members in terms of interest. I don't think ours was to make the government or make profit for the government. Ours is to recover losses. So if anybody suggest interest, I will oppose the interest. But if you suggest recovery of expenses in line of recovering the money, that I can live with. But certainly it can't be a matter of charging interest, because then we become a business. That's my take. Members, you have a different take in terms of leveling of interest. We're happy with that one. So there shouldn't be interest, but there should be recovery of whatever costs were related to recovering the money.
Chair, the next one was on Clause 1, capital G, and I think we've now dealt with that extensively, because in the latest draft they added the extra provisions relating to the accounting officer, but I think we're now in agreement that we only talk of the accounting officer. So that's just a drafting amendment that needs to happen. And that was it.
All right, honourable members, we've covered most of legal's concerns. We'll allow members, if they want to say something, we'll allow you to say something. If we're all happy, Kodis, I don't even know if you want to comment anymore. If you want to, we'll allow you, not now, we'll allow you, but we I'm saying the processes will allow members, then we will send both of you away to go and put this into acceptable, whatever the case might be. Just on the content, honorable members, is there anything we want to add, subtract before they go?
I think she mentioned on page 6 the May. So yeah, page 6 May to March.
Did you find it right in the bottom? All right.
Yeah, Chairperson, I don't have a problem with the legislation. I agree with it, but I just wanted to say to I forgot the processes of legislation at the end, but I was more interested in regulation. You know, we can have good legislation, but implementing that legislation is a problem. So I'm just saying that the legal advisors plus the Auditor General, when they help us drafting the regulations, it should be in such a way that we achieve what we want to achieve, which is the consequence management, and make sure that at the end of the day we'll have peace to buy, which is what we are trying to get together with the AG.
Honorable Singh?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to thank you in the manner that you've been handling the deliberations, because I think by and large we've agreed on very many of the very important principles that will strengthen accountability moving forward. And I think that's what we need to do. And let the legal come up with the actual drafting and we can look at it. I don't know if the content advisor can actually add anything more than what they've said, but I would think that we've reached a stage where let them come back to us with that final draft that we can consider and approve and take it to the next step.
I heard all those concerns. It is a concern most particular, not in particular the surcharge and the processes. The process of certificate of surcharge and the current process in terms of the Section 38 of the PFMA are the issues that we discussed. I had a meeting with them, Advocate Jenkins and Fatima. We agreed on the connect issues. So all those connections that you raised are the connect issues that we've already agreed. We sat down on Wednesday and we agreed on them. So I'm fine.
Thank you. In terms of, I'm looking at the legal people, in terms of the process, well, first question that I need to ask, and this one is purely just for me, I hear it even in the other committee where we're doing exactly the same thing. What and who is this animal called the joint tagging thing? Who are the wrong bodies that do that? Can you explain who is this joint tagging thing? That's my first question.
Chair, I can't speak to who the warm bodies are, but what happens is that legal services does a legal opinion on how it feels the bill should be tagged, whether it should be a 75 or 76. And it's then that committee that either yay or nays the opinion of legal services.
No, that was just for mine, because it comes up where me and Singh sit somewhere else, and they keep on saying that joint tagging will take a decision, and I just needed to understand who these people are. But in terms of what you're saying, ma'am, we must get permission, get permission from the House, we must write an explanatory note and all those type of things. I think what we are saying is, and you can hear it from here, we are going ahead with this thing. We need you guys to do whatever you need to do. If we need sign off, you'll bring it to the chair. The chair will come to the committee and say, this is it, can we sign it off? Time is of the essence for us. So whatever needs to be done, we're going to ask all of you our support staff to do it. And 24/7 you'll come to us and you'll say to us, we've now sent you that, it needs your sign off before we send it to the House, we've now done that, if you can assist us with that. I think that's what we are saying, isn't it? If you want to clean this up, I'm just looking at members. In terms of now getting the product of what has been done now, we don't need a meeting. We can send it to everybody for comment, isn't it? It's just the time frame from both your sides that we would need, because time is of the essence. So we look at all of you, including Cindy's team and Colis, everybody, to get us a document. Yeah, you're right.
Day and night.
Yeah. Cindy's suggesting that after everything is done, it's on our program, because we're going to go to our program, but on Friday the 20th of October, that's when we will come and look at all these things and everything that needs to be done. But I'm saying in the meantime, you'll send it to us. So if you could get it to us as is our normal practice, 7 days before the 20th of August, so that it's distributed, I mean October, the 13th of October, so we distribute it to members. Members will look at it and we'll put our rubber stamp. And if there's any process that must happen by then, Ma'am Ibrahim, even that must be done. If there's letters that must be written, so that on that day we can take it from there. Is that acceptable, Honourable Members?
Yes.
Ma'am Suzanne?
No, I'm just the gazetted that with the public hearing thing, so they continue in between, is what you're saying.
Public hearings will only happen after the 20th. The House is going to give us permission. We will have given the blessing. We'll give it to the public for 3 weeks, get their comments, and then process the comments. So all that will happen post the 20th of October. All right. Can we quickly go to the program, Honourable Members? Do any of you want to say anything on this matter before we go to the program? We'll start with you, and you'll have the very last word, ma'am.
Jay, thank you very much. Just for clarity purposes, do I understand then that the AG's office and specifically legal can work with the parliamentary legal advisors to package this thing? Is that my understanding? Thank you.
That's in order, Chair. I will liaise with Advocate Jenkins on his return to office on Tuesday. It's his matter, not mine.
Can I overstep my jurisdiction and ask that you run with it. You know, because and I'm only saying this because Honourable Jenkins will come back and we restarted. Every lawyer has his or her own opinion. So, and I don't know, I'm overstepping my mark. You know, if I must go and take Atakari and them to lunch, I'll do that. But for us, in terms of process, honestly, I'm not trying to take you out of your...
No, that's fine. I will discuss with Advocate Adhikari. Honourable Singh is keeping us very busy with state capture. We will discuss.
Can we make it a resolution of the committee? That Advocate Ibrahim must run with this because, you know... Yeah, I think so. Let's strengthen her and otherwise they'll...
That will be the resolution of the House, and then whilst you talk to her as your superior, we'll write a formal letter notifying her of the resolution of today's meeting without necessarily wanting to overstep her mark. But really, otherwise we're going to be going forward and backwards, and they also need to know who's their point person. So for all intents and purposes, this is the point person. All right. Thank you very much to both of you. You are free to stay or you are free to leave if you so wish. Honourable Members, we've got one more agenda item. And that is the program. And, okay. Now we'll go through. Okay. All right. Cindy says everybody says the program is probably the first one that has changed. She also indicates, and I'm aware of it, that we have been communicating, Comrade Kuno, with Scopa. If there is a communication problem, it would be on your side. People are not sending it to you. But even last week we invited you, and every time we have invited you, just so that is clear. The program before us, comrades, is that we meet, honorable members, is that we meet on the 20th to do what we are doing now. And hopefully from there then take the process forward. Then we will meet a month later, 17th of November, and we then look at our normal business, the AG's, financials and all those type of things, annual report. That's the 17th of November. The 24th of November, once again, it's the annuals of the AG, and I'm saying this is outside of whatever comes out of happens here, but I'm just talking about our normal processes. And that will be our business. So outside of whatever comes out of the Act, we've just got two more interactions with the AG for this financial year in terms of the statutory business that we need to do. Can we allow Cindy and her team to work on the basis of this one?
Yes.
And then anything else that comes out of today's interaction, Cindy, you let us know, we'll let members know. Like the public hearings, you can rest assured that in between this we'll have public hearings. You can rest assured about that. So outside of those things, can we use this as the program that we're adopting in the House? Thank you very much. Yes, Honorable Kuno?
Is it possible that Cindy can write a formal invitation to the chairperson of CROPA that when we meet on the 20th? Because I think the powers of heroes, so that the ones who are not attending. Oh, okay. Because I was just thinking that the powers of the Attorney General also, we are also interested to make sure that they pinch.
No, we have done it, but we will send a formal letter saying please refer to the program, and we can attach the program, it's not a problem, and say, especially for the 20th, yes, we will once again send the program highlighting the 20th Cindy, and we'll direct it to the chairperson of SCOPA. I think it's going to be in the interest of SCOPA that they are all here. It really is going to be in the interest of SCOPA that they are all here. Because this is, in fact, what we're doing, you are the biggest customer. It's not even us. You are the biggest beneficiaries of it. So that's what we will do, Honourable Members. Are there any other issues that members would want to raise between now and the 20th of August, 20th of October? Happiness. Mr. Ntobela, 20th of October. We meet to review what has happened today. Of October. It's a Friday. Yeah. So our next meeting, they will work. Cindy will keep them on their toes in terms of are they doing whatever. We'll get it on the 13th. On the 20th, we will give it our blessings and then take the process from there. Honourable Members, having said that, I wish you all a very, very, very pleasant weekend. Bye-bye.